Gibson, attorney at law, case number 98-0112. Before we begin, I'd like to tell both counsel that the Chief Justice will not be participating in this case. Mr. McCrory?
May it please the Court, my name is Mark McCrory, and I'm representing the Board of Attorneys Professional Responsibility in this, the matter of the disciplinary proceedings against John W. Gibson. The Board appeals from the referee's recommendation of discipline of 4 months suspension and asks that this Court affirm the findings of misconduct but impose a 6 month suspension as discipline. The Board seeks a 6 month suspension because a 6 month suspension is the minimum suspension necessary to trigger the reinstatement process for an attorney who wants to continue practicing law. The Board believes that it is important to have the reinstatement process invoked in this case so that Mr. Gibson will have the burden to demonstrate in the future that he has the ability to practice law without endangering his client's rights. It will require Mr. Gibson to demonstrate successful rehabilitation. In the last 5 years, Mr. Gibson has been disciplined by this court for misconduct involving dishonesty towards litigants, practicing law while suspended, and misconduct involving his bankruptcy practice. In addition, the United States Bankruptcy Court has sanctioned him twice for filing frivolous pleadings. Simply put, it's the board's position that a 6 month suspension will require Mr. Gibson to demonstrate with clear and convincing evidence that he can safely, competently, and honestly practice law. The misconduct in this action occurred during Mr. Gibson's representation of Mark and Catherine Hornberger. Mark and Catherine Hornberger owned a home, and their mortgage lender filed a foreclosure. September 1995, I believe. They went to see Mr. Gibson in 1996 to get help with a Chapter 13 debt repayment plan that would help them out of their problem. There was representation by Mr. Gibson for 2.5 years. During that time, no Chapter 13 plan was ever confirmed on behalf of the Hornbergers. During the last Chapter 13 filing period, Conti Mortgage discovered, to their dismay, that their mortgage was not recorded. And that put the mortgage lender in a position that mortgage lenders don't like to be in. They were an unsecured creditor. And an unsecured creditor in a Chapter 13 proceeding such as this, if the plan is confirmed, can get paid pennies on the dollar, and in some circumstances, zero. Well, on the other hand, a secured creditor, such as a mortgage lender that has perfected its mortgage under Chapter 13, must get paid in full. Conti Mortgage decided that it liked the idea of being a secured creditor more than an unsecured creditor, so it hired attorney Jay Pittner to file a motion for relief to allow the bankruptcy stay to be lifted so that his client could go across to the courthouse and record the mortgage. Mr. Pittner filed that motion, and he testified that when he filed it, he expected there was a greater than 50% chance that the debtor would object to the motion. And if it was objected to, he had less than a 50% chance of prevailing. He testified he did not think that this motion was a winner. To understand what happens next, I need to digress for a moment into bankruptcy procedure. Lifting a stay in Chapter 13 bankruptcy, according to their rules, goes under a process called default noticing. The moving party sends notice of the motion to any party that might be affected with a notice that says, you have 15 days to file an objection. The objection's not elaborate. It's not like responding to summary judgment. You don't need a brief. You don't need affidavits. You don't need anything. You just need to have the caption of the case and the words, I object. If no objection is filed in the 15-day window, the motion's granted by operation of law. It may be signed, the order may be signed by the bankruptcy judge, but Judge Martin testified that in the Eastern District, the courts routinely don't even sign the orders. It's just granted. So in other words, the default notice procedure means Anybody who has any objection has to move, or it will be granted without any further court review. When Mr. Gibson received this motion, he was out of the office, but as soon as he got back to the office, he testified that he gave this top priority. He said he was puzzled by the motion. He had never seen a situation where a bank, having lent about $55,000, neglected to record their mortgage. He testified that he and his assistants kind of laughed about it, saying, it must be awfully nice to have so much money that you don't worry about such details. But he did not know exactly what to do in response to this motion. One thing he did was he called Mr. Pittner, and Mr. Pittner convinced Mr. Gibson that he was serious about the motion, would proceed, and his client might even appeal if there was an objection. Mr. Gibson also contacted Attorney William Chatterton, who is the standing trustee for Chapter 13 filings in the Western District. He asked Attorney Chatterton if he had any opinions on this. The testimony is that Attorney Chatterton said, I'm busy today, I'm on my way to court, call me back. Mr. Chatterton said Mr. Gibson never called back. There was no objection filed. Mr. Gibson did not file an objection on behalf of his clients. The mortgage, the stay was lifted. The mortgage was allowed to be secured. Conti Mortgage went from the abyss of an unsecured creditor, lifted onto the pedestal of a secured creditor. They were put in a position where, instead of saying, having to say, please pay us, it was, Sheriff, make them pay us or we'll sell the house. This next came before a court's attention when the Hornbergers wanted to have their Chapter 13 plan approved. And at that point, Judge Martin and Judge Mr. Chatterton were discussing this motion and how this got allowed to happen on the record with Mr. Gibson there. And it turned out that that prevented the Chapter 13 plan from being approved, because Judge Martin realized that the creditors would do better in Chapter 7. So after 2.5 years of trying to get a Chapter 13 plan approved, the Chapter 13 plan was denied. Judge Martin said from the bench, quote, this plan can't be confirmed. I really can't believe, Mr. Gibson, that you understood what you were doing on behalf of your clients, or that you explained to them adequately for them to understand that they were essentially providing a mortgage that wouldn't otherwise exist on a debt that could have been discharged in a Chapter 7 or in a 13 through regular payments. These are people who could have kept their house if they wanted to. I'm just staggered by it. As a result, after some investigation, the board filed a four-count complaint. Count one alleged incompetent representation based on the failure to investigate and the failure to file an objection. Count two was a failure to keep the Hornbergers reasonably apprised of the litigation and to understand in a way that they could understand, or to explain in a way they could understand what their options were. Count three was based on making a false statement to the tribunal, and that arose out of Mr. Gibson's statement at the confirmation hearing that I talked to my clients about this and they decided that they wouldn't object. And count four was failure to cooperate with the board investigation by essentially making the same statement to the board. The referee concluded after a trial that the board had proven with clear and convincing evidence that count one had been shown, count two had been shown. That's incompetent representation and failure to communicate. On the last two counts, he ruled that the critical element of a knowing false statement was debatable. He said that it's clear that Mr. Gibson did not effectively communicate to the Hornbergers their options, but in his mind, he may have thought he did. And so he said there's evidence on both sides. I'm not going to find on those two counts, the last two counts. The referee then went on in his recommendation to say the board asked for a 6-month suspension, but that's based on the assumption he's guilty on all four counts. Therefore, I'm going to recommend a 4-month suspension since I found for only two. We're appealing that because the critical distinction is a 6-month suspension will trigger a reinstatement requirement. The board did. Yes, sir.
Let me interrupt for a moment. Early you said that the defendant, that the 6 months is necessary so that if he should reapply, he must show that he can competently practice law. How does he do that?
Well, there are two procedures that apply when there's been a suspension. If it's less than 6 months, it's essentially petitioning to your honors and...
I know the process.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I wasn't clear. I'm not referring to the process. I'm referring to substantively. How does he show that, hey, Bapper, I am competent now. So 6 months ago I wasn't, but now I am.
The process allows for Bapper to have some oversight, some requirements, perhaps ongoing requirements, attend CLEs in the core competency area, make sure that your office staff is tuned up to procedures so that you're not missing deadlines, things like that. They can have that sort of requirement. They can also have requirements that person practice in an environment with supervision or things like that. The board wasn't asking for 6 months because the board told counsel, file a four-part complaint and seek a month and a half for each part. Attorney discipline's not handled like a traffic code where each individual violation leads to a certain number of points. What we look at is a series of factors, including the gravity of the offense, when we look at what recommendations should be made. This court in disciplinary proceedings against Carlton listed four factors to consider when deciding discipline. Number one is the seriousness of the misconduct. Two is the need to impress upon the respondent the seriousness of the misconduct. Three is the need to protect the public, the courts, and the legal system from the respondent's repetition of misconduct. And the last is the need to deter other attorneys. Kind of organize my presentation today, I looked at two lists of mitigating and aggravating factors in attorney discipline. One was from Gene D'Amato, who published an article about it in the Wisconsin Lawyer, and the other was from the 1991 edition of ABA's Standards for Imposing Sanctions. And I pulled from that some lists that I think are relevant here for the court to think about when you're exercising your discretion, since you're going to impose discipline without deference to the referee, and that decision's made here de novo. First, one of the mitigating factors that I think is absent here is the respondent's appreciation of the wrongdoing. In the briefs, Mr. Gibson indicated essentially that he could brush off any harm to the Hornbergers rather quickly by saying they've essentially received free housing for 3 years from the time that they first consulted with Mr. Gibson in early 95 until the sheriff's sale in May of 98, arguing, well, they got free housing. First of all, I think that shows a misappreciation of his wrongdoing because there was a clear opportunity here to advance his client's interest, to preserve a $40,000 homestead exemption. When the Hornbergers first consulted with him, they knew they were having trouble paying their bills. A foreclosure had already been started. They didn't need a lawyer to lose a foreclosure case. They could do that on their own. They needed a bankruptcy lawyer to help them out of their problems. Second, a mitigating factor is remorse for the misconduct expressed in the record, and that is not present here. An absence of prior discipline is a mitigating factor, but that doesn't work in Mr. Gibson's favor. In 1985, he was suspended for 90 days in a matter involving unwanted contact with a client. In 1997, he was disciplined by this court for 60 days for practicing law while suspended from membership in the bar, making misrepresentations to opposing parties in litigation, dishonesty and other misconduct involving bankruptcy petitions. When you're looking at the discipline that you want to impose in this case, I think you need to look also at the aggravating factors, which I believe are present. The severity of the misconduct is significant. For 2.5 years, the Hornbergers tried to pay their debts through a Chapter 13 process that was ultimately frustrated. They lost $40,000 of equity that they could have protected if they had taken advantage of this. They lost their time. They lost all the goals of Chapter 13. As Judge Martin said, these are people who could have kept their house if they'd wanted to. A next aggravating factor is stated in the various publications as non-credibility from the witness stand. A number of people testified in this case, including Respondent Gibson. And the referee examined Mr. Gibson's excuse that he was afraid to file an objection to this motion because Judge Martin had sanctioned him on other occasions. And the referee said, "I find this such an excuse ludicrous on its face."
How do the Hornbergers, assuming that everything that you say is true, like the judge has said or the referee said was true, how do the Hornbergers get made whole in this? Can the disciplinary system do anything about that, or does that simply require the Hornbergers to go to court?
I think that the disciplinary system could envision restitution that wasn't sought in this case. I think they would have to go to court. And I think that that's probably not a viable option for them.
Why was restitution not sought?
I'm not aware of the reasoning behind that. One thing I might suggest is that just a frustration of the purpose of it. I know that in the prior discipline, when costs were awarded against the respondent, that he made clear to the court that he had inability to pay, and that he was in Chapter 13. Perhaps that's why they decided not to go through with it. I'm not aware that the Hornbergers actually expressed any interest in a malpractice case either.
Was there malpractice insurance? Is there?
I'm not aware of that, sir.
We've just gone through a full-length, full date, and we're in the process of considering some major changes. And one of the reasons is the concern, anyway, that there's a perception that this disciplinary system goes too easy on lawyers. If in fact the court wanted to consider restitution, would we need further briefs on the matter? Or are we bound by Bapper's recommendation?
With all due respect, I don't think you're bound by anything that Bapper has done in this case, and I think the record is adequate to set that forth. You have the causal link between the misconduct and the damages proved rather strongly through the U.S. Bankruptcy Court's testimony. One of the defenses that's been raised is that it would be wrong for the Hornbergers to try to take advantage of this mistake by Conti Mortgage. The argument is, look, you came to Mr. Gibson because you wanted a Chapter 13 plan. You wanted to repay your debts. You could have gone Chapter 7, but you elected Chapter 13. So they wanted to pay their debts. The testimony in the case was they did have plans change as things went worse. Mr. Hornberger started out as a middle-level manager, kind of bumped through downsizing at a corporation. The thing that strikes me as particularly grievous here is Conti Mortgage had a situation where they fumbled the ball, and this was a very unusual situation. They had every legal right to take advantage of the ball, pick it up, and win the game. There's some indication in the briefs that there's something morally wrong with doing that, that it's not fair. Judge Martin took that on directly, and he said, this is why you play the bankruptcy game. This is what you do in bankruptcy. When you go into bankruptcy court, you're acknowledging, we're adversaries. I can't pay all my bills. I intend to take advantage of the protection of the law. And in this situation, Had it been properly explained to them, the Hornbergers both said they would have taken advantage of this. They may have paid something to Conti Mortgage. They may not have wiped them out completely, but they would have had the option to get their plan confirmed, to pay very little over 3 years and have their home framed clear.
In a Chapter 7, aren't they allowed a homestead exemption?
They are allowed they can elect either state or a federal homestead exemption in Chapter 7. That's correct. But see, what happened was, when they were in the Chapter 13, there was a stay in effect that prevented Conti from going from unsecured to secured. They let them get secured. Then it was too late. I mean, Judge Martin even looked at, and his hearing transcript is in the record. He looked at ways to try to undo the automatic entry of the order, and there just was no way to do it.
What was the significance, counsel, of not claiming the homestead exemption? It's my understanding that when the matter was in Chapter 13, apparently the petition in regard to bankruptcy did not specifically make any claim for the homestead exemption. When it became a Chapter 7 proceeding, was the $40,000 exemption then claimed?
I'm assuming that it was, but I do not know. My knowledge of the bankruptcy record ends at the dismissal of the Chapter 13. The significance of it was that when the pleadings were initially filed, the bankruptcy schedules, Mr. Gibson did not elect any homestead exemption for his clients. That's a practice that either Mr. Chatterton or Judge Martin said was virtually unheard of. That's in the record only to show that this isn't just a one-shot bad call or misconduct. It's a pattern of incompetence that was seen throughout this file, throughout this representation.
Did Mr. Gibson claim that that was an oversight in some way, or what was his answer to that?
I believe it was a claim to be a clerical error, and it may have been a clerical error, but it's a very big clerical error that ought to be caught by a reasonable practitioner in the Chapter 13 practice. One of the things that I believe aggravates the misconduct in this case is Mr. Gibson holds himself out as a Chapter 13 primary practitioner. I don't want to use the word specialist, but he essentially limits his practice to Chapter 13s.
How does he do that? Is there something in the telephone directory, or how does he hold himself out as a Chapter 13 lawyer?
I believe he did that in his telephone ads and his newspaper ads. That he was looking.
You believe for, or he did?
Well, I think I can put my hand in a minute on testimony saying, where Mr. Gibson was cross-examining the Hornbergers, saying, when you read my ad in the newspaper, you know, you knew it was debt repayment, Chapter 13. That's what he primarily practiced, and I don't think there's a dispute about that. This inability to understand what to do with this motion is compounded by the fact it's at the heart of his core practice. He testified in his deposition he did not know where to go to research to find out what someone should do in this case. He testified that bankruptcy law was poor people's law, and there wasn't the ordinary ways to go and research things. I submit that anybody who has any experience in practicing law has to understand that when there's $40,000 or $50,000 at stake, there's got to be a way to research things. You can't simply slough it off by saying, this is poor people's law. The board respectfully requests that in order to protect the public, the court impose a sanction of 6 months. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McCrory. You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Mr. Gibson? Attorney Gibson?
If I didn't know myself, I wouldn't have recognized myself. He's right and he's wrong all over the place. And I drafted what my expert that I consulted, namely my wife, claimed is irrelevant. And it's the role of Judge Martin in my life. Judge Martin took a dislike to me, and he maintained it all the time he was on the bench. And he made my life miserable in specific ways. He wasn't on the bench more than 7 months when he ripped me to pieces in front of my clients in the courtroom for charging an extra $100 for adding a new husband to a wife who had a 13. He had more financial troubles than she had. And believe me, I did. $800 pre-inflation dollars. $800 worth of work for him, charged him one. Judge Martin ripped the skin right off my back. I was so red in the face, I was so embarrassed, and I was so upset that it was very difficult. And basically, he was saying that I charged $100 extra for essentially doing one 13, which I did two full 13s, and the second one was much worse than the first one. It was a new 13. Wife was dismissed, and the husband and wife had a joint one.
Counsel, one of your arguments that you set forth is that you object to the 6-month suspension because when the board brought the charges, there were 4 charges, and now that the referee has found sufficient evidence only to sustain 2 of them, that the penalty should be less than the initial 6 sought for 4. Would you comment on that, please?
Well, I'd sure be glad to. I don't think you should find me guilty of anything. No misconduct. No ignoring my client's wishes. But on that particular point, if you're going to start off saying that 6 is okay for these 4, and then you find half of gone, how does that fit? Well, what you heard the explanation. He once made the explanation that it was that it was serious. Well, it was so, it was not serious. 2, it was a cumulative thing. Well, do you know that this originally was bunched with the earlier complaints against me for, you heard him recite Judge Martin's evaluation of 2 of my cases, which resulted in sanctions, when they involved 2 sisters referred to me by a brother, because I did such good work for him. I did no work for one of them for a long time, because she just didn't have enough money to sustain her 13. To sustain your 13, you've got to have a budget. This is the way I used to do it. I'd say, this is what it takes to get you through the month. This is your net income. This is what you're going to afford to pay on your Chapter 13. And if they pass that initial test, which is really a brain burner, I mean, it's really hard to do that, but you know, I mean, then what you do is I would give them free. It cost me $2, a global family budgeting book, and I'd sit down with them and work with them on why they got to where they were. Mostly, it was not spendthriftiness. Mostly, it was people in trouble because somebody lost a job, had a baby, you name it. And these were good people. And I just feel one of the tragedies of this whole situation is I was, in fact, a Chapter 13 specialist, and I did it because it was the most wonderful experience of my life. Because there were a lot of great people out there that basically wanted to pay their debts. And were not getting any benefit for it at all. They were being hounded by collectors who called at night, who called and roughed up their children, who did things like suing a minor daughter for a collision that completely ruined the family car. And then tried to sue the people that owned the car, the mother and the father, and wonder of wonder, miracle of miracles, they were in a Chapter 13. that I did for them. But they were upset, so they called me. I call my friend, Bill Chatterton, who I call a friend. He is an attorney, very smart man, very sensitive man, very intelligent man, very compassionate. And I said to him, here, we've got a Chapter 13. It's not approved yet, but it's pending, and we think that we can correct it so that it will be approved. And they're not. It's filed. It's done. You've got to, you know, it's there in protecting them, we hope. That's what we want. What do you think? I mean, can they get around the stay of the Chapter 13 by suing the 17-year-old daughter that's in the home? That firm, by the way, is kind of interesting. There's some comment somewhere in the record that the 341 meeting was enlivened by the fact that a lawyer got in touch with, wrote a letter in detail calling questions about what was in the basic information that we set forth in the 13th, the first 13th. And I was nonplussed because what I always do is ask the people to prepare the filling out of the forms. And unless I see something which is outstandingly strange, I sometimes discuss it with them, but I don't really, you know, I mean, it's the client that's filled out that part. And that was the advice of Judge Glavert, the bankruptcy judge over in Milwaukee and in the State Bar's seminars. He spoke to us and said, your client is not your friend, so have them fill it out, fill out forms, so they don't come back to you and say, you know, you got it wrong, buddy.
Mr. Gibson, isn't it still your responsibility to review those forms and to determine whether or not the homestead exemption has been claimed? You don't leave that to the client.
I don't mean to interrupt you.
Right.
It went. I didn't do the last one. I didn't do the last set. See, if seven mysteries came to light, and it was really something that I couldn't work out with Bill or with other lawyers that had handled things like that in the past, what I would do is recommend that they go to a 13 practitioner who had a decent amount of seven experience so that they would pick up on that. Most of my clients didn't have houses to worry about housing relief. And that doesn't save me from my responsibility to make sure that it's the right one. I did. Yeah, I know he didn't mean to, but he did misspoke. We put the wrong one in. We put in the state. And the state is lower than the federal. The federal gives you $40,000. And that's the one that should have been in there. An earlier investigation by a BOPR investigator said that wasn't really something they should proceed on because it could have been adjusted if the other things had been corrected. And that's what I want you to think about. Think about this. I ought to read you a short poem because I want to be a writer. And I decided 5 years ago that I wanted to become a writer. And I was up in Green Lake at a creative writing program sponsored by the Elder Citizens. And there I was. And I checked my office daily. And I called my office, and that's when I found out that it had been, you know, this thing had been received. I said,
this thing being the motion.
Being the motion, of course. When I said, I'll be back tomorrow afternoon. This was on a Thursday that I called. And I said, let's discuss it tomorrow and see what we have to do. And he said, well, I hate to tell you this, but I am a reservist, and I'm going to be gone tomorrow. And I said, well, Monday, what's the date? You know, I got the date when it was due. It was due May 9th, and this was September, or this was April 24th, or something like that. So there was plenty of time, it looked to me like, to get to Bill, talk to him. The reason I go to Bill is because Bill Chatterton processes from a lawyer standpoint.
Mr. Gibson, could you stay in front of the microphone, please?
I'm sorry. He processes lots and lots, thousands and thousands of cases. And so of all the people that would have had an opportunity to come across this particular weird thing, how weird it was is another story, and that's in Reed J. Pittman.
Well, Mr. Gibson...
It almost never happens.
Who was the trustee?
Bill Chatterton.
Didn't he testify during your hearing that when he first asked you about that motion, you denied any knowledge of it?
It was just a slip. See, that day was the day they got back the order. And what he said to me was, he said, I saw the order and, and that's the way the conversation went. And see, when he called me, I was talking to him and he was talking about the order. And I said I hadn't seen it. Because the judge had signed the order and mailed it off. It had arrived in my office the day before. And so I hadn't seen it yet. You know, I mean, when my assistant, Al heard that we were talking about this, he said, wait a minute. And I said, wait just a minute, Bill. And then he came in and he said, the order came in yesterday, but I hadn't shown it to you. And so he opened it in my presence, gave it to me, and I said, you mean the order? Well, a year later or whatever it is, I mean, I don't know how much time has gone by, he just got it confused. Because the evidence, please, please read the evidence of what I did when I got the motion. On Monday, after I got back, I came back and looked at it on Friday, but I didn't. It was too late in the afternoon for me to do anything about it. I couldn't call Bill. In fact, I did call Bill, but he was not there. It was late in the afternoon. So I resolved to do it on Monday. And we had until the 9th of...
To do what?
To contact, find out what was involved. I called the best person to find out about the substance. And I would just say to you, be on your guard. Because Bill Chatterton, according to his own testimony, was the only lawyer there, only lawyer involved in any of this, that had ever heard of this thing happening before. And he said, under oath, he said he had saved $40,000 for one of his clients. And I have gone to him over and over again, and I have many times asked his opinions about what to do. And rarely have I ever disagreed with him so that I would have done something that he was not backing, that he was not supporting. Is the green light mean I sit down?
No, you have when the yellow light goes on, you have 5 minutes to complete your remarks, and then you will also have an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Sorry. What I'm saying is that Bill was, there was a lapse. First thing I did, after my assistant came in, he brought the stuff in, we talked about it, and devised a little scheme. The little scheme was I was going to call Bill, talk to him about it, then I was going to check with Dittner and find out, whether he was going to hang in and extend this out in case it came out on the wrong side. I mean, that would add more time. And then I called my client in order, same day, within minutes of each other. And as Pittner said, it doesn't make any sense that John wouldn't have known about the motion because he called me about it, and then he didn't know exactly when the date was. But I made those three calls, serially. And Al was in the room with me when I made the call to Bill, and he stayed long enough to hear that I was talking to Bill Chatterton. And then he was over his face. We just went out. And Bill and I went through this, and we got to the point where he was explaining that he had to go to court and that he couldn't talk to me right now. And he said, what's the timing on this? And I said, I can't remember just offhand. I think it's May 9th. And I hollered at Al verified that it was May 9th. And I said, it's May 9th, so you've got time to do it so we can get under the wire with your advice. And then he said that he would call me back. Now, I want to tell you that of all the people I have dealt with in the government service, and I served the federal government overseas, in Washington, overseas, I came back here, and I served as deputy DA, and I've served at all governmental levels a lot. Of all the people that I've ever had to do with, Bill Chatterton is the most reliable person in terms of answering telephone calls, and it's really wonderful. He's very reliable, and he is intelligent and compassionate, and he's a good guy. Sometimes I've had differences with him, but mostly it's differences with him that are dictated or were dictated to him, or he was strongly advised by Judge Martin that Martin wanted him to come down one side or the other, and there was enough of a debate so he could feel comfortable, and he would do that, and I would disagree with him. The most interesting one came just about 2 weeks before this whole thing blew, and it was when I was sick to death of what Martin was doing in a particular area, and that area was involved in something that was before him. I said, I've had it, I'm going to appeal him. Because every time I've appealed him, I've won. But it's cost me money, and I don't have very much money. He said, I wouldn't do that if I were you. He waved his finger at me. And I said, why not? And he said, well, I think the judge is going to rule on your side of it. And I said, are you sure? Because he's done this, and he said, I'm sure, don't do it. I didn't do it. And the judge ruled on my side of it. Which was wonderful. I really liked that. I liked it when my clients came out on with their interests advanced. The reason was the second one was to Fidner. Fidner said he was serious and would likely proceed with it. Not necessarily to appeal, but if you got the stay lifted, it would be taken over to the circuit court. And he would recommence his action. He'd get into the thing, whatever he was going to do. He would amend, and the judge would sign it, and that would take care of it. Then I called my client. And my client and I had a long telephone conversation. I tried hard to get the phone record so I could prove it. But I can't tell you, but it proved to be impossible. I just couldn't get it out of him. It was a long talk, and it went over all the things that you would want me, as supervisors of lawyers in action all over the state, to have done. I read to her the motion. She said that she was aware of it, and she was aware of it, because she was aware of it at the same time I was, because In the certificate, there was an affidavit that it was sent to her, to me, or to them, husband and wife, and then to me and to Mr. Chatterton. Well, I talked to her about what was happening, and I said, we've decided not to keep the house. How do you feel about that? And she said, I really am interested in doing a number of things. I've talked to Al about it. I've written a letter to Mr. Chatterton. Our car is dying. We've got a whole bunch of things that we have to do. I'm afraid, we have not been able to come up with a budget to pay the mortgage off. They had, in the testimony, the materials we got from Fidner, they had not paid any mortgage payments for 2 years prior to their coming in. It was only the starting of, the foreclosure that may have triggered their action coming to get the Chapter 13. And they did not pay any more mortgage payments, I don't think. And now the yellow's on, so why don't you sit down?
You have 5 minutes.
5 minutes. Well, I just would like to say that I would appear, you know, when I filed a Chapter 13, it passed that test, plus the test of detail in the materials. In other words, they had to not only have income, they had to have stable income. So there was some chance that they were going to succeed at their 13. I never, not once ever, filed a Chapter 13 that I did not feel would pass muster. Not one time. And it was not for the creditors, it was for the debtors. Because if they would organize themselves and work on their budgets and try to pay, it's a wonderful law. It's the best law ever. It encourages people to do what they ought to do anyway. And it's the most wonderful way for young lawyers or old lawyers or the lawyers, period, to reach out and touch people who have never had lawyers working for them. I went every time.
Mr. Gibson, could I ask you a question?
Sure.
You want no suspension. And the referee wants a 4-month suspension, and Mr. McCrory wants 6-month suspension. And he argues that you need the 6-month suspension so that you can go through a formal reinstatement process. Now, Justice Babish asked about this. What is your situation now, and what would be the problems created for you going through the reinstatement process?
4 years ago, I hated poetry. Now, I'm a poet. And if you don't be careful, I'll read you one of my short poems. They're haiku, and they're only very short. But my short poem appeared in the best haiku magazine in the world this time. And another poem entitled Elkhart Lake appeared in the Wisconsin Fellowship of Poets, of which I am a proud member, and it's in the year 2000 fundraising calendar. I want to become a writer. The reason I asked for this extra time was to point out a couple of things that I've already pointed out about procedures and about what happened and about the role of Judge Martin. As I understand the law, he shouldn't be affording either positive or negative recommendations if he were a Wisconsin. Wisconsin judge, he's a federal judge. But it's been my understanding that there's a close connection between federal judges and what they could and should do, and state judges and what they could and should do. And he's not supposed to do that. He's not supposed to. I'm practicing in front of him. At least he had enough sense that he did not enter into our Chapter 13. My wife and I were in a Chapter 13 for 10 years. We paid over $105,000 on our debt, and 15 more after our 13 was converted to a Chapter 7. We were forced into a chapter 7 by the IRS. But it's just a sad thing to me. I've devoted practically my entire professional life. I was doing 13s before they were even, it's a new law. And nobody's going to ever appeal anything as you pull up, because they're poor people. And the lawyer that goes into the appeal has got to pay for it himself. And if he's a poor person's lawyer, he's not going to have a lot of money for that kind of thing. Does that answer your question? I want to be a writer. Yeah. I don't think it's very...
Do you want to practice law again?
No. I have 3 clients left. Two of them are pro bono clients. Two of them are pro bono clients that have complex matters. In other words, I can't move them to another lawyer because the other lawyer is going to have a complex question on his hands and is not going to have a client that can pay. So that has lingered, and I have continued to help them. It's mostly non-lethal work. It's more help, you know, ombudsman-type work. The third client is me, and you know the wonderful old song about a lawyer that has himself as his client, or the client who has himself as his lawyer. I know it's true. I think it's true. And even if you wouldn't nag me, my wife... It was my wife's $1,000 that Judge Martin took from each of those two clients. And that needs examination because he approved one of them. And you heard the grounds he gave. It was that I knowingly submitted a 13 that I knew couldn't succeed. Well, it was...
Your time is up. You'll have 5 more minutes for rebuttal. Yeah. Mr. McCrory?
Your question about what someone could do to ensure safe practice by Mr. Gibson is probably more complicated by his argument. I don't know what this court could impose, but I think that to protect the public, we're going to need to at least have a reinstatement proceeding. At this point, in the face of testimony by a United States bankruptcy judge, who said that Mr. Gibson absolutely should have objected to this motion. A bankruptcy judge who said he could think of no reason to deny an objection to the motion. Mr. Gibson stands before this court and says, I am guilty of no wrongdoing. There is no remorse. There is no appreciation of his misconduct. There is no understanding of the facts in any connection to reality. Because this record shows the testimony of Judge Martin, William Chatterton, Mark Hornberger, Catherine Hornberger, and Jay Pittner are all very consistent about what happened in this case. The only dispute is Mr. Gibson's version of the facts. Let me start first. He told someone that this misconduct was bunched in with misconduct that he had previously been disciplined for. I litigated that discipline, the one in 1997. I know that misconduct was not bunched in there. Certainly, misconduct in the Hornberger case was never considered as part of the recommendation of the 60-day suspension from 1997. Justice Crooks asked about the homestead, and I found the reference to that in the record. It was at paragraph 24 of the referee's findings that said Attorney Chatterton said it's unusual for debtors not to claim a $40,000 homestead exemption, yet that is how Gibson prepared the bankruptcy papers. So it was Mr. Gibson's Chapter 13 filing where that wasn't accomplished. The referee's findings were that, at paragraph 18, the Hornbergers did not necessarily want to leave their home. If they had a choice, they would have been able to keep it. The referee found that there may have been conversation between Mrs. Hornberger and Mr. Gibson about this motion, but he was clear. He said it was clear and convincing that the Hornbergers did not understand what their options were, and that if they had understood, they would have objected to it. He said their testimony was clear and convincing. And it should be, because we have all sorts of res gestae proof that that's exactly what happened. Because after the confirmation failed, the Hornbergers and Mr. Gibson go to Mr. Chatterton's office, and he describes his explanation of the motion to them. And it sounds like scales falling from the eyes, because he talks that they were stunned, they were shocked, they were angry. Mr. Hornberger, in his testimony, said, you asked Mr. Chatterton, said, I'll bet he said the Hornbergers looked pretty stupid because they were so upset and shocked by the way they had been treated. Moreover, when Mr. Gibson told the bankruptcy court, I talked to my clients about it, and they understood, and they've decided not to object. At that very moment, Mr. Chatterton stood up in open court and said, wait a minute, Judge, that's not the conversation I just had with Mr. Gibson. He said, what motion? And he brought it up at that point in front of the bankruptcy court, and the record's here in this court. Mr. Gibson didn't say, no, you misunderstood me. Mr. Gibson didn't say, oh, that's a lapse of Mr. Chatterton, as he's arguing before you today. He didn't say any of that. It is clear from the referee's findings that at the center of Mr. Gibson's practice, his poor people's law practice, where he is trying to help people from their creditors, that he had an opportunity to save a major victory for these clients, and he let it go by the wayside. The referee was correct that constituted incompetent representation. This court needs to find what sort of discipline should be imposed upon a person who claims no wrongdoing. We respectfully ask that you impose at least a 6-month suspension. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McCrory. Mr. Gibson, you have 5 minutes.
I would just, in the first place, the question was, what did I do in the 9 days or so that I had to talk with my clients, discuss with them what was going to happen, and what they wanted to have happen. And when I called her, she was concerned about not selling the house, because our discussion on the 13th, the second 13th, that was another thing that was very disturbing, because when I asked for the file of the first 13, I was told by Mr. Chatterton that it had been destroyed. And I think that anything where you're going to have a question about a lawyer's behavior in connection with something like that should not be destroyed. That's not good. But I don't know why it would happen that way, but I was concerned about it because we were having continuing discussions throughout this whole time. Remember, it was the ninth that we had to file it. We had to file the objection to avoid having anything else happen. The reason I didn't worry so much about Bill talking to me was that the clients made the decision, and they made it in no uncertain terms, and they were only concerned with selling the house so they could buy some other things. A car, for example. They talked this over independent of me, but I was aware of this happening. Al Romeyer, who was my assistant, discussed the need to write a letter seeking permission from Mr. Chatterton to buy a house. And what she was going to use was any proceeds they got from the house. And that was an after-the-fact kind of thing. If they approved the plan, then they would have continued until the house was sold, and once the house was sold, everybody would be paid out, including the legitimate first mortgage holder. What I asked was, and I did not explain that they would get a free house by playing the bankruptcy game. And the question is, what do you do when you come across something that is so strange? It's something that you're unfamiliar with. I consulted with Bill. Bill had a particular case and could have told me, and if he told me, it would have been over. I would have, despite the fact that I think it's better for people to do budgets and to do 13s, if they had an absolute lock on Judge Martin, no problem. I mean, I wouldn't have had any trouble with my conscience. It was in my client's interest. The idea that I wouldn't work in my client's interest, you just can't believe how terrible it is. frequently in the course of the Chapter 13, people lose track, and there is a need to have a hearing where this is reexamined. As soon as I get notice of that, I call my clients and sit down and talk with them and see what was happening and try to work out something. But one way or another, I went to that hearing, and I fought for their feelings and their rights, and I was often the only lawyer around that was doing it. And I did it over and over and over again because I wanted them to succeed. The idea that I would not serve my clients is an invention of this complaint and this spokesman. I work my tail off for my clients all my practice long. The only thing I feel bad about is that, you know, according to my wife, this is a lock. You're going to find me guilty, and I'm going to get grieved. I'm out of the practice. The two are complex and pro bono in me. That's what's left. And I do not seek, nor have I sought for the last year and a half, any clients. And I've told people, I've passed them off to my friends, to people that can handle the courts of controversies. That's it. So you don't have to worry about requalifying me to restart. I am going to learn to be a writer, and I certainly hope that I'm not going to write about this. And yet, my temptation is to write about this and write about this and write about this, because there are some terrible things that have happened here, not the least of which is that the judge has been permitted to try to hound me out, and I feel a little sad that he may think that he has done it. Actually, what's done it is that I've told my little stories and my wonderful experiences to my friends and family, and they've gotten bored. And reading a John Grisham novel, I suddenly thought the thought, and the worm crawled into my head, and it was as follows. If you can learn to write, you may be as successful as John Grisham. And it was too late. The law had lost me, and I will always be a lawyer. I will always be a proud lawyer of you all.
Thank you, Mr. Gibson. That concludes the calendar for today's cases. This court stands in recess.